Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Well, it's great that you can join us here in the middle of this long weekend, this precious commodity, particularly at this time of year. I'm not sure how you spend your long weekends, perhaps catching up on TV, all the shows that you've missed over the last few busy weeks. It's not how I've been spending my weekend, mostly because over the last 2 weeks I've had exams and I've been procrastinating quite well by watching lots of TV. So I've got a few shows that might interest you that you might like to check out and watch tomorrow. Some things that I found quite enjoying and distracting over the last 2 weeks when I should have been doing some other study. The first is... Quality show, Ice Road Truckers. And in particular, it was season two that I found at the video store. No, it was at the library, sorry. And I told myself and told Sarah that this would be a show I could put on in the background while I studied and wouldn't be a distraction at all. Something to just fill the silence of our house while I spent the day at home working. As it turns out, the show at times captivated me and I found myself watching whole episodes. As these men worked in the Arctic Circle. And the thing that amazed me was how here in the furthest regions of the globe, these men would drive trucks over the frozen sea. And they would... what was amazing is watching... it's mostly oil rigs and test drill sites, and whole communities kind of spring up on the ice, and these men drive trucks out to set it up, and everything's designed in kit form so it can be loaded onto the back of a truck, and when they have to, they move the whole site 100 kilometres and try drilling for oil somewhere else, and then at the end of the season they have to get it all back onto dry land before the ice melts and everything kind of sinks into the sea. It's a great show. Another one that I've been watching a little bit of lately is Monster Moves. I don't know if you've seen this. Rod, I hate to say, I think it's replaced Iron Chefs on Saturday night on SBS. But it's another exciting show. It highlights human ingenuity as these moving crews move not just little houses, but giant, massive structures. And it was about 2 weeks ago that I think Sarah and I were captivated by a show where they were moving two churches kind of in America across the countryside. And it's amazing seeing a whole church on the back of a truck kind of just rolling up and down the hills and across cities. And another one that's captivated my attention is Richard Hammond's Engineering Connections, one of those Top Gear spin-offs where he looks at kind of all the different things that go into different human endeavours like giant bridges, giant oil rigs, and if you're looking for it, here's another connection with tonight's passage, Taipei 101, which was at the time the tallest building in the world. And Richard Hammond looked at all the different things that had to go into the construction of this building. It's an amazing testimony to human ingenuity and just sheer cleverness and constructive ability. Well, the one thing all these shows have in common, as I've hinted at, is they all highlight our human ingenuity, our human creativity. They all highlight what people can do when they set their minds to it. And there seems to be that same celebration of human ingenuity, at least in the start of our passage today, in those first four verses of Genesis 11. We're looking at a time a few generations on from the flood, from Noah and the flood that we've been looking at over the last 3 weeks. God destroyed the whole world, save Noah and his three sons and their wives, 8 people in all. But as Genesis 10 tells us, that these families have been growing and multiplying, the population has been growing, and the human race is starting to increase in number again. And as you might expect, all being descendants from one family, Genesis 11 verse 1 tells us that the whole world had the one speech and the one language. And as this new human race moved outwards, they started exploring the post-flood landscape. And it was there, as they moved eastward, they discovered the plains of Shinar. Now, my map is not terribly brilliant, but here we go. This is where the plains of Shinar are. Here, just over here, in what is what later became known as Babylon, but is now in modern-day Iraq. It was here that the people moved, and these explorers, these discoverers, said, actually, here's a good place. Here's a good place as any to settle down. And so the explorers turned into settlers. And after the scholars are right, although I don't know if many people today would want to move to the middle of Iraq and say this is a good place to set up home. Back then it was. It was a fertile, a rich land, a good place for people to set up, to make the base, the cradle of a new civilization. But of course, while this land was rich and plentiful, a good place to grow crops and raise herds, there was a little bit of a problem there in that there were no stones, no mortar. And that's a problem, of course, if you want to start building something. They didn't have the kind of constructive tools that we have that you might think about when you wanted to go and build a house. I look out, even in our suburb, Bulleen, and there's lots of houses rising up really quickly out of wooden frames or things like that. People back then would look for stones and mortar, what was at hand to construct their buildings. But there was none of that there. And so in a testament to human ingenuity and their creativity, the people, the engineers of the day, kind of came together and had the idea that if there's no stones, we'll just build our own. We'll make our own. And they said, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. So take some clay and heat it up or burn it or dry it in the sun so it gets nice and hard. And then we'll have something to build our new city with. Because, of course, bricks in and of themselves aren't much use to anybody. It'd be pretty boring if at the end of verse 3 they said, come, let us bake bricks, and they made a huge pile of bricks, and that was it. It'd kind of be a silly story. The people said, let's do something with these bricks. Let's get creative. And so they said to each other, come, let us build a city, a great city. A big city here on this fertile plain, a place where we can settle, a place where we can start a new great nation, a place where we can raise families and set up shops, a place where we can settle down and find peace and security and safety. Making of bricks and building cities is a great creative act. And in fact, the people's words, come, let us make, come, let us make, echoes God's words in creation. When he said himself, come, let us make the world, let us fill it with animals. Come, let us make humankind in our image. We seem to have here a testimony to human creativity and human ingenuity. In the middle of drawing up plans for this great city, and as they set about building it, they say to one another, hey, why don't we build a giant tower as well? A giant monument in the center of our city that it will stand out. This is the first skyscraper. They want this building to reach into the heavens. I don't know what you think about when you think of what this Tower of Babel might look like. You might have an idea of, here we go, Taipei 101, a giant kind of skyscraper rising up into the heavens. Of course, you know, they didn't really have, as clever and as creative as they were, they didn't have the technology and the ingenuity to create something as big as this. If here at the start of the service, you might call to mind those images that came along with the scary soundtrack, the classical representations of the Tower of Babel like this one here, which even more scarily, I think, came as a background image for Microsoft Windows 3.1, I think it was. I remember having to stare at that picture for quite a while until I worked out how to change it. But these classical representations of what the Tower of Babel would look like and a giant structure rising into the city, rising into the heavens. Of course, we're not quite sure exactly what this Tower of Babel looked like, but we can get some a better idea than even representations like this. If we look at the kind of towers that were built in Babylon, that city that came after Babel, that was kind of built in its place. There, generations later, as Babylon became a great city again and the center of a great nation, or several great nations, well, the people sought to build new towers. People think it was in a copy or an image, in the likeness of this original Tower of Babel. And so we know a future king in generations, in centuries to come, King Nebuchadnezzar built a giant tower that looks something a lot more like this, what's known as a ziggurat. something that looks a bit like a pyramid that's kind of had the top leveled off, a big tiered, a building of giant tiers leading up with a staircase kind of going up along the side. And right up on the top, just kind of here in this image you'd see, would be another building. And this would be a temple, a place where the people could come and make sacrifices to their God. But it was more than just a place where the people could come and worship, because also on this top level, there'd be another room. And this is where the people thought the gods themselves would come down and dwell. So often these rooms would be set up with a bed or a cot and kind of basic items of furniture, that whatever it is a god needs to make himself feel comfortable. The idea for these civilizations was that this would be the dwelling place of God. He could come down from heaven and live here in the midst of his people, could receive the sacrifices and offerings that were made just next door in the temple, and could easily come down and bless his people, watch over them and kind of be involved with them. So it's likely this first Tower of Babel, this first skyscraper, was like this, and these later generations kind of copied this design. Imagine in the midst of one of these first cities, this is a mighty, majestic building, kind of the crown jewel of the city. It becomes a beacon in the landscape, so when you're out in the plains surrounding the city, you can look up and see and go, ah, there's the Tower of Babel, there's my city, there's my home, and not get lost. So people say in verse 4, they built it so they might not be scattered. Of course, more than that, it becomes kind of the center of their civilization, calling all people to come into this great and glorious city of Babel with their mighty and majestic tower. One of the people said, we want to make a name for ourselves, make ourselves known, make ourselves great. Have the word go out around the whole world that this is Babel and this is our city and this is the tower that we've built. Come and live here. This is the place to be. All in all, in these first four verses of Genesis 11, we have a great testament to the human spirit, to human ingenuity and accomplishment. As people become first explorers and then settlers, as the engineers and architects and builders become involved in creating a great city. God's verdict in verse 6 seems right. If as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan will be impossible for them. A great testament to human ingenuity and ability. It's worthy of their own documentary on SBS. I don't know what you call it, the Babylon construction, Babel construction stories, or a mighty tower, a giant spire, I don't know, something like that. But worthy, great accomplishments. But as work progresses on this great city and this great tower, it's time for a site visit. Not a site visit by WorkSafe or by the city engineers wanting to make sure everything is safe and sound and of such a quality that people can live in it. Rather, this is a divine site visit. And we see this starting in verse 5. We get the hints here straight away that things are not quite what they seem. The people sought to build a city and to build a tower that reached into the heavens. You see in verse 5 just how little they've actually managed to accomplish. As God, the author of Genesis, almost paints a picture of God in heaven kind of peering down and having to go, what is it they're doing down there? They wanted to reach up into heaven, but God's sitting in heaven going, I can't even see. I'm going to have to come down and have a closer look. What is it that they're doing? And of course, when God comes down and when he sees, it's not like he didn't already know, but when he comes for a closer look, he's not too impressed with what he sees going on there. We read Genesis 11, 1 to 4 and think, how clever, how creative are these humans being? How wonderful is everything they're doing? It's only a few generations on from the flood when everything was wiped out. They've started again. They've built a new city, a new nation, a new civilization. They've managed something pretty amazing. But that's not God's verdict. We expect him to be like a father, proud of his children, but he acts more like a child. Kind of sees a tower of blocks that his brother or sister has made and immediately comes over and just knocks it over. Not that I ever did this as an older brother. We kind of get the picture that God is being a bit territorial here, that he's not happy with a tower rising into the heavens, or he's a bit grumpy and doesn't want to see people working together. He's a bit frightened by the fact that as everybody with one language doing things, is a bit frightened that they'll be able to do anything they want. You can have the idea that God is here trying to control them or limit what they can do. This is not the kind of verdict we'd expect. We want God to come down and say how proud he is of what they're doing, the way they're working together, the way they're achieving mighty things. But instead, God pronounces his judgment on the people, on their city, and on their tower. Because the thing is, God looks beyond the veneer of our human accomplishments. He sees beyond the city and the buildings and looks into the very hearts of people. God looks down and judges our thoughts and our hearts, what's going on inside, as these few verses say or remind us. Psalm 51 says, God desires truth in our inward being more than anything else. 1 Samuel 16 reminds us of this when, remember, when God is showing Samuel, who he is anointed to be king, and David has a number of brothers, and Samuel thinks it would be each of them. They're big, strong, strapping lads, but God says, no, it's David. Because I look into I don't look at what the man looks at, I look at the inside, into the heart, not at the outward exterior. So those other verses there show God looks into what's in our heart. And when God looked down at the city and at the Tower of Babel, he looked down into the hearts of the people. And what he saw there was something that needed to be judged, something that was not right. For pretty much everything the people were doing was wrong, was sinful. God's desires for the human race had been made pretty clear. God had said to Adam and Eve when he created them, go forth and multiply, fill the whole earth. God gave this same command to Noah after he exited the ark, not once but twice, to show how important it was. He said to Noah, go forth and multiply, go out and spread. God at this time desired to see the whole world filled with humanity, with humankind. But here the people have said, we're not going to do it. We're going to build a giant city for ourselves because we don't want to be scattered. We want to build a giant city so everyone can come here and be gathered together. In their hearts, they'd sinned and rebelled against God. Not only had they rebelled against God in their desire to build a city so that they might not be scattered, even this mighty tower that the people had built, this kind of crown jewel of their civilization, even it is a failure. They built this with the idea that God would come and live here and dwell here, that he could bless their works. They're here either attempting to replace God or at least to control him and say, God, this is where you live, just in that room up there on the tower, thank you very much. It's about time you came down and started blessing everything we do. We want you to respond to us. Rather than what they should have been saying, which is, God, we want to respond to you. They'd forgotten that God had created the whole world. The whole earth was his. He didn't need a dwelling place made by human hands. He dwelt in the heavens. He controlled things. He ruled things the way he desired, the way he wanted. He wouldn't be at the beck and call of anyone. And again, we see another judgment on the people. when they did all this work, in verse 4, so that we may make a name for ourselves. All this work, all this human ingenuity and creativity was bent towards making themselves great, to building up their name, to making them great in all the world, rather than making God great. They were concerned in their pride for themselves and not for God. They'd even forgotten that it was God alone who had the power to give them a name. God alone as the creator and ruler of all, who's the only one who can bestow a name upon the people. They desired in their pride to see themselves built up, to see themselves made famous rather than God. So in all this, all their human ingenuity, all their human creativity we see in verses 1 to 4, this giant spire that they'd built upwards, what we really see is a massive spiral downwards. In a way, it just follows the pattern we've already seen over and over and over and over again in chapters 1 to 10 of Genesis. So people continue to rebel and rebel and rebel against God. But it's even worse here in chapter 11. For here the people are united, not united in their endeavours, but united in their endeavours to turn away from God in setting their heart against His will and His purposes. When God looked down in Noah's day, He saw that the whole earth, the whole world was wicked. But there was one man, Noah, who was found righteous. Here in Genesis 11, when God comes down and looks upon the whole world again, they're all united, they're all of one mind. There is no one, there's no single righteous Noah amongst them. Everybody is united against God. And so God enacts His judgment and punishment upon the people. Seeing their sin and their wickedness and how deep and depraved they are, how all their thoughts are evil, how they've been driven by human pride to work not against God, for God, but against Him, to build up their own tower and see their own security and their own name made great. God announces His verdict upon them and upon their great tower. But God remembers His promises to Noah. I remember when God looked down in Noah's time and saw the earth was wicked, He decided to wipe them out with a flood and start all over again. But He promised Noah that never again would He do something like that. And so here, God does not wipe out the whole earth with a flood. He doesn't even knock down the tower in a mighty gust of wind and level the city. Rather, God does something much simpler than that. He just confuses their language so that the people can't understand each other anymore, so that they can't work together. Their unity has been shattered, and now they can't continue constructing their building. Now, it's not necessary that one morning they awoke and someone spoke German and their next door neighbour spoke Japanese and the person across the road spoke English and the person on the other side of them spoke Hebrew. It's not necessarily a giant confusion of languages like this. It could mean something as simple as God just changing the dialect between the people. Think of the differences between English and Scottish and Welsh and American and Australian and Victorian. All the one language, but all subtly different, so that it's hard sometimes to understand people who speak one of these other dialects. I'm from Queensland, and when I came down to Melbourne about 10 years ago, I found it really hard at times to understand people. You all speak so slowly. I know the joke normally goes the other way. Actually, what I found strange and confusing was nobody here says g'day, really. I grew up not only in Queensland, but in the country where g'day is kind of are so common you wouldn't believe it, and where people don't finish words and things like that in the rush to get their sentences out. When I came down to Victoria, it was a little bit hard grappling with the changes and differences in the way people spoke. But we all speak English. So God might have been doing the same little subtle changing here. Just enough so that people could no longer understand each other. So they can't understand one another and can no longer work together. Therefore, in a rather, in some ways, in a kind and gentle way, putting a halt to what the people are doing. Putting a halt to their working against God. And the people sought to gather together there at that city, at that place, so that might not be scattered. But we see here God enacting and fulfilling his will and his purposes. From there, he scatters all the people. They wanted to make a name for themselves. Well, God fulfills their wish and gives them a name. But a name of shame. He gives them the name Babel, or which is in Hebrew quite close to the word confusion. Showing how in this simple act of judgment, in God confusing people's languages, he sees his will won out. He achieves his purposes. He'd wanted to see the people scatter, and now by simply confusing the people's languages, they can't understand one another, and their great work kind of falls apart, and everybody moves on. People move on from here to fill the whole earth. Well, the question that remains for us is, what is the purpose of this story? What is the purpose of this account of the Tower of Babel? Just another story we can teach our kids in Sunday school that sounds really great and easy, of God working against a great tower. What are we to take away? What are we to learn from this? And I want to look at briefly three possible meanings, three possible things we might take away from this account. It might be here just to inform us. It might be here to warn us. Or is there even here a message of hope for us? Well, first of all, information. Genesis 9 verse 11 tells us that this is why it was called Babel, which, as I've said, in Hebrew means is very close to the word confusion, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. On one level, this story is here, it just gives us an explanation or a reason, an account for the creation of different languages and tribes and nations. You can see that it was God's doing, it was God's work. It's not necessarily that this is a bad thing. As we said, this was God's act of judgment, but it was also in some ways in line with his will and his purposes. He desired that the whole earth might move out to scatter and fill the whole earth. It's only natural as people settle in different places, as great distances appear between populations, that their language would gradually change over time as words became prominent in one area and less prominent in another, and as you developed your own little ways of speaking. It could be just here that God sped up the process. But whether it's a good thing that God desires or an act of his judgment, Genesis chapter 11 tells us that the creation of languages is something that God brought about. So it could just be that this passage is here just to tell us that, and we should leave it there and go home. I know why Japanese doesn't sound like Hebrew, or why I can't understand my Scottish neighbour across the fence. Sarah will ask, because we do have a Scottish neighbour, and sometimes we have to ask him two or three times, what? Could be that Genesis 11 here is just to tell us why that is so, but I don't think so. I think there's a bit more to the story. Here we go. And the second thing, it's pretty clear to see, is a massive, massive warning, isn't there? A warning that we should not be like the people of Babel. They sought to make a name for themselves, to build up their own kingdom, to trust in their own power. to make themselves great. But this story tells us that that's really not a good idea at all. Seeking to build up our own kingdoms and not God's is a futile exercise. This gets repeated over and over again in the Bible. As I've said, Babel becomes known as Babylon. And throughout the Bible, this is held up as a city of men opposed to God. And time again, God warns the people not to be like those at Babylon. Time and time again, God pronounces his judgment on Babylon. In a way, pronouncing his judgment on all those who would seek to live opposed to him. So here in this first account of this happening, in the first account of then Babel are being judged, and this first human kingdom are being judged. There's a massive warning for us not to be like them. Of course, that might look different for each of us. It might not mean going out and baking bricks and building a city with a giant tower. But there are lots of little ways that we can echo what the people here in Genesis 11 did. We might seek to make a name for ourselves. We might desire that people look upon us and think well, think good of us, but for nothing else but our own glorification. I know before I started studying theology, before I started thinking about even ministry as a career, I studied science and for a while worked in a research lab. And in the scientific world, you're about as good as your name is. How often your name has been published, how often your name appears attached with an article or a publication. So I used to know guys who every now and then would type their name not into Google but into PubMed, an index that catalogues scientific journals. And you kind of look and say, ah, I'm here three times, you're only there twice. I'm pretty good. It's a bit sad when you put in some of the directors of our institute whose name appeared on hundreds of journal articles. But in that world, you're as good as your name. And when you go to apply for a grant or seek a new job, people look at how many papers you've published, how big and how great, how well known is your name. And it's like that in many other jobs and industries, isn't it? And we can fool ourselves into thinking that this, into letting our hearts seek and desire this, to see our name be made great, that everyone might know who we are, that we might be famous, even if it's just in our field, or famous even if it's just in our workplace or our community, that people might think, oh yes, George, he's such a great guy. He's always friendly, he's so kind and generous, he's always helpful. We might want to see our name built up, might want to see our name glorified. But this passage stands as a warning if we're like that, for rather we should seek to see God's name built up. People of Babel gathered together to build a great city and a great tower for themselves. We might not do that, but as was once famously said, a man's house is his castle. We might seek to build up our own homes, our own houses and dwellings, to fill them with great possessions. That's always be at work, finishing them off or improving them. At least always at work trying to pay them off so that they can be ours, our great fortress, our great security and safety in this world. Or we might be like the people of Babel and seek to control God. We might say, God, if you'll just bless my study this week, then I'll do whatever you want. I'll come to church this Sunday. God, if you help me pass this exam or get an A on this essay, or that this meeting at work might go well, you do this, God, and I guess I'll do something for you. These are ways we can replicate what the people here at Babel were trying to do in building that giant tower and saying, God, you come and dwell here and bless our work, attempting to control God, to bend him to our will. was a big warning for us if we seek to do that. We might, like them, might seek security in our own labours. Seek security in our financial position, in our stock portfolio, in our bank account. Seek security in our position at work or any other thing, rather than seeking our security and our safety in God. In all of these, we're seeking to, whatever it looks like for you, replace God as our king, to seek not his kingdom but our own, to see not God's name built up but ours, to seek not God's glorification but our own. And all this, this passage in Genesis 11 stands as a great warning for us not to do that, not to seek our own kingdom but God's. Now, for as Jesus would say, seek first the kingdom of God, and all these other things will be taken care of and added onto you. The great purpose of this passage is to give us a great warning not to be like them. My final question, though, is there a message of hope here? As we read through this passage itself, that seems to be a pretty hopeless situation. In all the accounts of human sin and God's judgment that have come before, there's been some respite, some relief. Adam and Eve sin in the garden. God creates garments or clothing for them and spares their life, delaying the punishment of death. Cain murders his brother, but God provides relief in the form of a protective mark so that he might not be slain by someone else. Even in the flood, that great act of God's judgment, there was relief and hope as God saved Noah and his family. But here in Genesis 11, there is no hope. There is no relief. There's no lessening of the judgment. Everybody's language is confused. Everybody is scattered. On the surface, there seems to be no hope. But hope is yet to come. In some ways, there's hope for us, for God's will prevail. God is shown to be greater and more powerful than any human kingdom. And so for the original readers of this passage, the original readers of Genesis, this account might have given them great hope in times of trial or distress. So as the nation of Israel was about to enter the promised land, and as the account came back of the great cities that were there, cities that reached into the heavens, Genesis 11 would give the people hope. So remember that God is greater than any city. God is greater than any people, and no matter how massive it might be. If you know your Old Testament, you know that as time wore on, the people of Israel failed to hear God's warnings, to heed the warnings here in Genesis 11, and they sought to build up their own kingdom and their own name instead of God's. And so God, as punishment, God once again scattered them and sent them into exile, back to Babylon, back to Babel. Imagine how the people felt as they, as slaves, as captives, entered that great city and saw King Nebuchadnezzar's replica of the Tower of Babel, that great tower, that new tower. But even as slaves, as captives, entering into this foreign land, they could have hope. As they remember God's great power over even towers like this. Likewise, for the first Christians, for indeed us, whenever we're faced by opposition, by powerful governments, by human powers and kingdoms, we can remember that God is more powerful. God's kingdom will prevail. His will win out. But more than just having hope that God will win out, we can have hope in God's kingdom. But it's not just here that God is working against human kingdoms. He doesn't want to see any kingdom at all built up. But God has his own plan, his own kingdom, which he wants to see increase. That's this kingdom we see over and over again developing in the Bible. And ironically, all the things that the people were afraid of, all the things that they were fearful of and sought to provide for themselves, we see God beginning to provide even in the very next chapter of Genesis. The people were worried for their name. They wanted to make sure they were thought of, they thought well of. And the people were worried about being scattered amongst the whole earth. In the very next chapter, in chapter 12, we see God approaching one man, one family, Abraham, and saying, Abraham, I will bless you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and I will make your name great. Out of you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Out of you, to your family, all nations will gather. The people were worried for their name and worried that they would be scattered. But God starts to provide for his people a name for themselves. And it's a far greater name than what the people could have come up with by themselves. For it is the very name of God, the very name of Jesus. We see in Philippians 2 that God exalted Christ and gave him a name above every others. And this is the name that we can now bear. Indeed, in Revelations, Jesus promises to write this name upon our hearts, to write upon us the very name of God, to provide for us what the people in Genesis 11 sought after. The people were worried about being scattered, but God shows that his desire is to bring people all together, but together for his kingdom. We see the first fruits of this at Pentecost, where God's Spirit comes down upon people of every nation who are gathered there, and as they receive God's Spirit, they're able to understand one another. And again, this picture is extended in Revelation when John sees that picture of heaven of people of every tongue and nation and tribe praising God. God will bring people all back together. God will restore all languages to one so that all people can understand one another. But for his purposes, to see his name made great, to see his name praised. And as the people sought a city and a city for themselves, God promises that he will provide a city far greater. Not just the temporary earthly Jerusalem, but a heavenly city whose architect and builder is God, whose foundation is God. And not a tower reaching into the heavens, but a city that comes down from heaven, as we see in Revelation 21. From this passage, we should take hope that God's will prevail and that God's kingdom will prevail, and that we should hope and trust in God's kingdom. We've seen a warning not to trust in ourselves, an encouragement to hope in God's plans and God's promises. And in some ways, the two go together. For if we're not seeking God's kingdom, if we're hoping in God's kingdom, we won't be seeking after another. It's easier not to trust in our own might if we're trusting in God. Friends, we should seek first the kingdom of God and not after our own kingdoms.